So what's the shortcut to samadhi? What's the PowerPoint presentation 5-bullet list of samadhi? I think letting go. Let go. If you want a quick answer to this, is let go of all that preoccupies you, all that comes along and says, I'm important, work me out, think me through, finish me, take me up. You've got to do me before I allow you to meditate. Yeah, this kind of thing. You learn to say, I've heard you, thank you, I let go. Letting go is an immense power. I know it's not all, but the things that generally stop us from deepening our calm is some form of preoccupation, some form of being entrenched in, hooked, something. You know, the gesture of the closed fist, which we are not aware is closed, but in fact that it is closed is what holds us back. I want to put it very simply, the prime scapegoat, if you want, in Buddhist demonology, is a thing called grasping, upadana, attachment, identification with. These are all possible translations for that key term. Dana, as I hope you have understood, means giving, generosity, it's that movement. Adana is the opposite, it's taking. Yeah? Upadana is a reinforced form of taking, generally translated as latching onto something, holding onto something, grasping, pulling towards, attaching. That's what it does on a, say, emotional, affective level. It's the heart that does want something and does not want to let go of it, does not want it to change. If you look at this same upadana procedure on a mental level, we could probably best translate it with identification. There's something in my mind that I identify with, either positively, this is mine, I have one of these, this is my thought, my idea, my copyright, my nature, my diagnosis, my psychopathology, my talents, my virtues, my marriage, whatever. It's mine. You establish, to put it simply, a relationship of possessiveness to something that is in fact a content of your experience. Can be as fleeting as a thought, it can be as big as a concept as your role as a CEO of this and that company. Attaching to this on a mental level is generally you identify with this. Positively, this is, I am this, this belongs to me. Negatively, this would be, whatever others may be or may be doing, I am not one of these. Thank God I don't have those. I'm the good guy here. You are the bad guys. Thank God I'm the good guy. So this also is a type of attachment. You do it negatively. Any honest inquiry into that process will probably leave you with the sober assessment that you do a lot of that. For psychological reasons, we have a predilection to do that because it helps us to create some local safety. In terms of spiritual development, and in fact in terms of psychological well-being as well, you run into major difficulties with this principle because it just doesn't work. You cannot establish in a sort of existential way a genuine relationship of possession with something. Can't even do that with your breakfast. The most concrete way of establishing possession is probably eating something, you know, ingesting it, making it part of your body. That is probably the most territorial and primordial act of appropriating something. And even that doesn't really work in terms of possession. You know, you can it can nourish you. But then it obeys laws that have nothing to do with your mind. It obeys laws that have to do with your digestive processes, with metabolism, with... They're kind of not... They're laws you are part of, but they're not your laws. You don't decide what happens with this morning's breakfast right now in your digestive tract. You know, it knows perfectly well what has to happen, and you can't influence it, really. Most people can't really influence their peristaltic movements. You can influence certain things, like your breath. But in terms of proper possession, is a very abstract concept. Although it works, every legal structure, in fact, most major civilizations begin where people start respecting other people's property and possession and take it serious when they start pulling up fences and like things like that. But in absolute terms, in existential terms, all this is a joke. It doesn't belong to you. Not even what you have eaten belongs to you. So, much of our pain is directly due to the fact that we try to attach to a state, to a content, to a quality of experience that, by its very nature, is likely to change. And we try to hold it, not just hold it generally, we try to hold it at the good bit, yeah? Try to maintain the good bit. And we put considerable effort into this. So much so that we overdo it. And that's what stops us from becoming calm. We establish a continual pattern of appropriating fleeting, more or less fleeting aspects of our experience. And the very antidote is obviously letting go. Not just kind of, you know, grudgingly acknowledge that I can't keep things as I like them, but actually letting go. Deliberately say, well, fine, I let that thought go. I let that mood go. I let that sound go. This is something which really helps. It doesn't make any value statements about that thought. Please understand me correctly. It doesn't say thought are useless. Or it doesn't say, because things are changing in this world, this is an ugly, illusory world, and it's not worth the dying. It doesn't say what Faust says, for those of you who know Faust. You know, he says, everything that arises is worth that it disappears. That's not what the Buddha says. The Buddha says, everything arises that is conditioned, and all conditions will come to some form of cessation. And it's not that they're bad, or it's not that they're worthless, but you have to reconcile. At the end of the day, you have to reconcile with that. That you are not in control, that they come, that things come and go. All your thoughts, all your impulses, all your emotions, all your ideas, all your images, all your body states, your health, all this comes and goes. And you have to learn to make peace with this. And one way to make peace with this is to not attach to states and objects and things and relationship and try to hold them. Now that's easier said than done. But most of the time you will actually notice that you hold on not just to the really nice things in your life, but the really gratifying, powerful things. Most of the time you will find out that your mind, once it has established a relationship of appropriating things, it holds on to anything. People hold on to the most horrendous views of themselves, not because they feel good about it, but simply because it makes them feel they know where they belong now, although the view they have attached to may be perfectly miserable, it still somehow seems to give a sense of, I know at least, you know, who I am or where I belong, or basically the devil you know is better than the devil you don't. And it looks like we're doing very bad with change. We're doing very bad with things that we are not certain, with things that we cannot predict. And we seem to be easily seductible to even attach mentally to things that are overtly painful, simply because they have the reassuring quality of telling us that we know a little bit something of this world. Why would somebody believe that he's a loser, or that he can't really do anything useful, or that he's not worthy of love, or that he has never really had anything, any emotion of value in his heart? You know, why would people believe such things? They believe such things on one level because they've been inculcated with that belief, and they believe such things because in some way it provides an identity. It's a bad identity, it's a miserable identity, but it's an identity at least. It tells me who I am. And it seems to be very difficult not to know who we are. Yeah. That seems to be frightening. Yeah. And the mind has established ways of creating certainty out of things that it cannot ultimately create certainty. So, and out of this comes a habit, and out of the habit comes pain. At the end of the day, attaching to things, identifying with things, is very painful. If I have established that I am intelligent and clever, because the thought that pops in my head seems intelligent, clever, the thought goes and I stay behind as the intelligent and clever guy, that feels good. You know, I like being intelligent and clever. But then Gary comes and has an even more intelligent and clever idea. And I have to negotiate, you know, what does that mean to my intelligent self if Gary has intelligent ideas? You know, is Gary the intelligent guy in here? You know, is he more intelligent? And then Gary may have established a relationship with his intelligent thought. His intelligent thought may have passed, but then you have two intelligent selves in the room trying to compete with each other about who is more intelligent. Yeah? If that makes you think of your last board meeting, then yeah, that's probably a lot what happens. Yeah? So we infer from the fact that we are sensitive beings and capable of holding ideas and conceptions and notions, we infer from that a protagonist, conveniently called I or self. And then because that poor thing doesn't really exist, we need propping it up continually. And we prop it up by identifying with little bits. You can't really go through a whole day with one intelligent idea, but you could say, you know, you could get 20 minutes of life out of it, you know. So you kind of jump from one 20-minute existence to the next 20-minute existence. So in the morning, you are doing your morning bit, and you're the being behind the coffee cup, and then you're the being that commutes to work, and then you go into your work self, and then you take your first phone call, and you become your corporate self, and so forth, yeah? You continually adopt roles, and you identify to some or less degrees with those respective roles. And obviously you try to choose roles that are in some ways rewarding for you. Things you'd like to be, or things you feel are safe, or things are well paid, or, you know. So we establish continually relationship to things I think, I feel, I aspire to. And this relationship of possession or of identity with the content of my experience becomes a structural pattern in my life. Even if you become a monk, believe somebody who spent the better part of his adult life in monastic situations, the last thing people let go after they've given up, you know, sex and TV, football, possessions, all kinds of things, the last thing people would let go is their opinions and their Maybe they're meditation objects, if you're lucky. In fact, it's even worse. The amount of stuff you can give up generally translates into a more fervent intensity in which you hold on to what remains. We've had the privilege of seeing Peter Brook's Mahabharata, either live, it's probably a while ago now, but maybe in video you see Dhritarashtra at the end of the day. He's standing there and doesn't want to go up the ladder because the dog cannot go to heaven. He's lost all his friends and he's fought, and he's finally made it to the stairway to heaven. This is ladder, and he's there. The only thing he has to do is climb up, and then it said, sorry, no dogs admitted. And he doesn't want to go, because that's the last thing that he's left with, his dog. And he doesn't want to give up his dog. I'm not sure whether this is the really canonical version of the Mahabharata. As you know, there are probably a few. But I think that was a telling point. I realized he has gone through everything to arrive at that point. And he comes to that point and he realizes, my dog doesn't come with me. And he says, I'm not going. Doesn't want to go. So sometimes we diminish the quantity of our attachments and identifications, but we keep a few, cherished few, and with great fervor uphold them. So what does that mean for my practice for calm? If I want to be calm, let's quote Ajahn Chah. He says, if you let go a little, you become a little more free. If you let go a lot, you become a lot more free. If you let go completely, you become completely free. That's the simple point. His famous Bloy Wang, this is the big statement he has made time and again. If you care, and make sure you do, look at some of his videos or listen to some of the translated talks, read his books. This is a big emphasis in his teaching of meditation. Let go. Let go of what preoccupies, what binds your energies. And what will remain is sudden spaciousness. You will be less defined, it will feel less safe in some way, and yet you will have suddenly more space. You will, once the object is gone of your attachment, the focus of your grasping, the thing you have habitually preoccupied yourself with, you will notice there is a space. You will notice there is a mind ground, in front of which things take place, processes, objects, events. And if you sense that mind ground, if you sense the background, you can't give really many attributes to that. It's empty. It's spacious. It's capable of understanding. And it's, in a profound way, peaceful. And this is something that allows the mind to become more calm. There is no calm in the waves. Remember the analogy from yesterday. Chasing the waves, pacifying the waves, go only for the waves with the frothy top. Any amount of looking for peace within the layer of waves, of the surface movement of the mind, will not bring you peace. To find peace, you will need to let go of that preoccupation and take a dip, dive through that layer and see what comes below. The mind and its objects are separate. It's like water that you have mixed with sand. You have it in a glass, you shake it, and it seems cloudy. If you put the glass, if you let it stand for a moment, the solids will sink. The water will become clear. That's the relationship of mind and its objects, its events, the things in which we reify our world. If you wait for a moment, if you stop shaking the glass by trying to get it clear, if you stop doing that, it will inevitably become clear by its own. It's the nature of things. The mind and its objects, its processes, its events are not one and the same thing. They are separate. And because they are separate, they will reveal the nature as soon as you stop with the shaking. Yeah? So to know that may help, just to let go. Things don't disappear because you let them go. Your loved ones don't disappear just because you let them go. In fact, they disappear less if you let them go. Probably disappear more if you try to hold on to them. I'm not saying it's not worth fighting for things. You know, if you have a kid and the kid is crying, you don't let it go and kind of go into a blissful state of deep absorption. There's somebody dependent on you. You have a responsibility there. You don't want to abscond into some happy, schizoid, parallel dimension, you know, where no kids are disturbing your peace of mind. This is not my message. But you will need to let go of you as a mother or as a dad or as an older brother and sister. You will need to let go of that role at some point. In fact, I would recommend you keep continually letting go of that role. You fulfill your responsibilities as good as you can and you keep letting go of the role. Because any role is going to be suffering. So the telltale sign if you don't let go is pain. Preoccupation, anxiety, anger, discontent in its many fashions. Don't feel ashamed. Acknowledge that it takes place. Try to find out where the grasping takes place that makes this aspect of dukkha possible. Where the pain finds its origin, and try to let go of that. So that'd be my first point for the quick bullet list of samatha is letting go. The next point would be kind. Be very kind, in a sort of sustained, interested, attuned way kind. Kind with yourself. Learn to establish kindness and benevolence as states of mind you keep an interest in cultivating. If you believe that your aversion gives you just the right amount of bite to make you effective and to be taken serious in your job, then I believe somebody who has invested many years in becoming creating the right sort of bite and has run for many years off the tab of aversion in his life and paid the price for it, in fact. This is one of the things that will stop your mind from becoming quiet. There's nothing as effective as making your mind incapable of quiet, which is aversion, sourness, disgruntledness, forms of discontent. You need to find a way to make your mind glad, to make your mind loving, caring, benevolent, and interested. If you tell your mind to shut up and let you meditate in peace, it is very unlikely that it will do that. My mind takes that doesn't take it lightly. My mind likes to be treated gently. It likes to be invited rather than nudged and forced and bullied. If your superego goes a bit too bolshy, generally your meditator mind will not likely take to that. It generally goes to sleep. It'll become droopy, inexplicably fatigued. Suddenly things go dark. So gentleness, and the basis of that gentleness is a willingness to accept how it is right now. There's an English word, acceptance, which is precisely what I mean. It's just that the word in itself is a bit flat, and it doesn't actually tell you how to do it. So acceptance is often, I don't know how it sounds to you, but for me, acceptance has often the slight sort of almost order, you know, I should accept this, you know, accept this. And it's not quite easy to accept things to which I have resistance. So if you wanted a word for something that helps you to have a mind that is capable of becoming still and staying calm, obviously something like radical acceptance would be the word. The problem is it doesn't tell you how to do that. It sounds maybe good to you, radical acceptance. Not because it's nice or because it's good or because it's particularly true, but because it's happening. Accepting that this is the movie I'm in right now. It's not I'm in the wrong movie, I got to get out. Got to get out of this movie so that I can get into the meditation movie. You know, this is the movie. You know? This is the one I'm in, and this is my meditation kit. One body, one mind. And if I can accept and meet it where it is, then I have a good chance that things will transform very quickly. So my second bullet point would be acceptance and metta. Not just teeth grittingly say, well, fair enough, you know, can't change it. But actually a welcoming, benevolent interest and inquiry into how it is. Whether that be your mind state, whether that be the thought content, whether that be the body state. A particular theme in your life that seems to take dominance right now. Making peace with this. Not because it's good or not because it's right or because it couldn't be improved, but right now you have to be with it. And the most effective way of being with something is being kind. Yeah. This is transcultural. Human beings develop the most, almost anything they want to learn and they want to do, they develop under conditions of a trusting, accepting, friendly, kind environment. And if you can generate such an environment in your heart, whatever is happening in your life, then your chances will be a lot better for the mind to become still. So, point A would be, of the second bullet point, point A would be acceptance, point B would be metta. So infuse mindfulness with loving kindness. As somebody who is part of the mindfulness movement, I am conscious that the Buddhist notion of mindfulness goes far beyond the notion of mindfulness that is much documented today in circles which propagate mindfulness. The notion of mindfulness in Buddhist teaching is always infused with not just sobriety, but with an interest, a benevolent and a metta-full interest. So if you take that out, your mindfulness may become sort of a clinical vigilance, or it may become a sort of an observing, slightly controlling quality. Particularly if you use the visual metaphors. If being mindful means observing, watching things for you, which many Buddhist teachers, and I'm afraid I will have to count myself amongst them, or at least for some part of my career, if you translate being mindful with as watching or observing, then chances are that your mindfulness has a slightly clinical tinge. You know? It has a slightly controlling aspect to it. Because the visual metaphor, remember, being mindful in the Buddha's way of speaking is being in relationship with. Now, if your sort of relationship is one of watching, then this instills always a sense of distance. It creates perspective. Yeah. So if being mindful for you means watching things and observing things, this is very powerful if you have dangerous things going on. Depression, anger, anxiety, things that want to flood you. Watching these things and being capable of watching them rather than joining them is very useful. It's a powerful technique to disidentify with the content of your experience. But for many other things, simply watching your experience doesn't really transform it. If you're not in danger of being flooded by it, then watching your experience may not be the most effective way of actually getting to know it, or deepening your knowledge of it, or becoming more intimate with it, or in fact, understanding it. Maybe you should sniff it out, or go and gently prod it, or maybe you should taste it, maybe you should feel it. You have a very different relationship to something that you feel than to something that you simply watch. What you feel, that feels you. You can't be voyeuristic on the level of touching something. You can be seeing things in people without being seen. Yeah, it can be seeing can be a very one-sided experience. Being in touch with something is a very different. It's a much more eye-level experience. Whom you touch, you are being touched by. Yeah. So, if you translate being mindful of, would be my suggestion or my request, be aware that you're not simply watching this. Some things are being very successfully watched, like dangerous flooding things. It's good to be able to get into safety from those. But some things you don't understand by watching them. You need to have another kind of relationship. I suggest that the basis for that relationship is metta. Metta and sobriety. Loving kindness, benevolent interest, willingness to be with something, and looking, feeling, soberly acknowledging, if you go closer, what that makes you feel like. This is your best chance of understanding. Third point on the bullet list would be play the cook. Yeah, be like the cook. Figure out what your king likes to eat. Your king is your mind. Figure out what makes the mind more peaceful, what makes it more happy, what allows it. What does your mind enjoy? Not just what does it like to be tickled by most. That's not what I mean. I mean, what does it make your mind more content? What does it make your mind more calm? What does actually give your mind the feeling of its own strength and its own stillness? If you don't digest beans very well, you will probably stop eating beans. Yeah, it's as simple as that. And you find out that things make your mind agitated. Things you have power over, obviously, there will be enough things remaining you don't have much power over that will keep agitating you. But we have a remarkable amount of say in where our attention goes and how we intend to live our lives and what we do with the powers we have. Learn to be circumspicious. Learn to be good in finding out what actually helps you. What makes the mind more clear, more transparent, more peaceful? What fosters your inspiration? You know, learn to get to know your king, basically. That's the message. Be curious. Stop trying to have another mind. Yeah. So much of our dukkha is directly due to the fact we don't want the sort of experience we have. Asanga, a famous Buddhist teacher, I think he's dated roughly in the 4th century, author of a number of influential teachings that have been greatly important to the Tibetan traditions and have probably been important to the early Indian traditions as well, but we don't know much about those, has written a couple of points that are dangerous for samatha practice. One of them is laziness. Another one is forgetting the instruction. Another one is overexertion. Yeah. And I think the last one is the opposite. It's not staying with it enough. Not enough heart, not enough patience, not enough exertion. Good. I'd like you to go and do some walking meditation for the last half hour of this morning. And clarity of your exercise is also a very helpful point. The more clear you are what you are doing, and most importantly, the more clear you are what you are doing if you find out that you are not doing what you have decided you are doing, what I call plan B, is very helpful. Don't expect your mind just to stay with your breath. If you've been thinking for 40 years and you've been graded in school and you keep talking, emailing and texting all day long, don't expect your mind suddenly staying with an in-breath and an out-breath, you know, because you just have asked it to do so. So it is necessary that you have plan B in place. And plan B says, when I notice I'm not doing what I have decided I'm doing, I'll go back to what I have decided I'm doing. No judgments, no grumpiness, no identification with me, I can never meditate. All these angelic people around me are probably having absorptions and I'm still writing shopping lists here. Yeah? None of this. Just kind of come back without drama, back to the breath, back to the body. Right now, for walking meditation, it would be back to the posture and back to the sensations in the soles of your feet. Yeah? So.